All right, so I think we are on the move again. I don't see it in the. I'm waiting for my man in the chat to give us the all clear. But it looks like to me we are all systems go. There he is. There he is in the chat. Well, good. Welcome back to another classic movie stream. Now, before we get into it, I know I'm probably going to be echoing a little bit more than usual, and I'm going to try and just speak a little bit quiet because I've been changing the setup. It's a work in progress, and I'm working on it. I'm gonna have like a really nice cozy place, but I'm not quite there yet. I've also got a bit of a hangover, because I was out last night, so it's gonna be a bit more of a low energy one than usual, I think. But nevertheless, we are here. It's all changing. It's all go at the moment. And yeah, at the end of the day, you've got to get out and you've got to socialize. You know, that's what it's all about. But Morgoth the drunk. Well, not really. Like I didn't even have that much, but I just can't take it the way that I used to when I was a young chappy on the big market. These days, 5 pints and I'm done and dusted. And then the next day, I'm really punished for it. But it is what it is. I'm not anywhere near as much of a party animal as I used to be. But whatever. We're gonna kick it off. How's Endeavour?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm enjoying the summer.
Yeah, I mean, so what we're gonna cover today is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and it's I would say I would put it in the kind of 70s realist kind of, you know, when we've done these streams, we've often touched on how different eras have got different kinds of films to them, where the 80s is optimistic and the 90s tends to be quite sort of ironic and bombastic, and then in the 70s you've got these more dour films, and I would put One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest into that kind of genre, this sort of grainy realist quite serious movies of the time. It also marks the first ever Jack Nicholson. This is Jack Nicholson's first entry into the classic movies canon, which is also happens to be one of his greatest ever roles. It's a really he really just dominates the movie, which he has to because of the nature of his character in it. So, what did you make of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Endeavour? Had you seen it
Well,
before?
I had actually recently. The first time I saw the movie was last October, so only a couple of months ago, and then I watched it again in anticipation for this stream. I thought it was a good movie. I don't know if it was maybe I don't know if I'd say it was one of my favorites ever, but I thought that it's definitely entertaining, and it did take me a bit to think about what I would want to talk about for this stream, what themes were would we could find in there, and how could we could relate that to the present day. But the more that I thought about it, I thought that there actually are quite a few things to get into. So yeah, it's an interesting film, and you can't go wrong with Jack Nicholson's performance. He is absolutely fantastic in the film.
Yeah, he absolutely, you can see why he's one of the greatest movie stars of all time. He completely just owns this movie. Like it's really quite terrific how great it is. The funny thing is as well, it's one of those films where on the surface the story is very simple. It's Jack Nicholson is he's been sent down for having sex with an underage girl. And he was in the jail, and then in order to get out of jail, he's pretended to be mad. So they've sent him to an insane asylum, where he thinks he's going to have he's going to have it easier. It's going to be like, and it kind of makes sense, but that's not how it goes whatsoever. And so what he begins to do is sort of buck back and rebel against the system of control in the insane asylum, which leads him into confrontation with the infamous Nurse Ratched. And at the same time, you've also got a cast of side characters who've all got their own issues, and they're all completely dominated by Nurse Ratched, by the system. And it begins to this sort of escalation of tension between Nicholson sort of representing freedom, the free spirit, and Nurse Ratched as this kind of monster, which we will get into all of this, of course. And then eventually, I don't think I'm going to give much in the way of spoilers, but he leads them out on a fishing trip. He brings in prostitutes. He leads a rebellion because he wants to have the World Series on television, or at least the radio. And then eventually the electroshock therapy comes in and he turns into a vegetable. And then one of the other main characters, who's mainly silent, is a huge Indian, who's a great actor, actually. I've enjoyed some of the movies. He's in Outlaw Josie Wales as well. He's in Orca the Killer Whale, which I'd like to cover one day. And he kind of represents this caged spirit, which, you know, because we're getting into One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you do have to touch on the boomer question. And there's a lot of boomer in it, but in a sort of good way, which we can come on, because in a way, it's all kind of like, I mean, I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit, but it is about rebellion against the system. But I'll have more to say on that a little bit later on. As for just the straightforward plot, that's kind of it. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's also worth noting that he actually went, he decided to basically fake being insane, Jack Nicholson, in order to get out of doing the labor. So in the, he had a job in prison or something like that. And to get out of doing that job, I think that they said that was why he had basically faked his mental illness. So he wanted to get out of it by, he thought it would just be, he could just be more lazy, really. So the other thing is that he didn't know that his prison sentence would be extended. So he thought like he was only going to be in for like, I think what it was like a couple years or something like that. But there's a scene where one of the black guys who works at the asylum says to him, "You're not getting out in 68 days. You're going to be here for years. You've been deemed insane."
He's understood that there's a different element of power here, which is worse than a standard prison system, because what he's been doing, and this leads him into confrontation with some of the other inmates, is that he's been rocking the boat and running his mouth off, and nobody told him that he isn't actually under the jurisdiction of the prison system anymore, but under the Mental Health Act. And it turns out that they've actually got a lot more power than the prison system itself, because how long he stays within the asylum is entirely up to them. Whereas if you're in a prison, you can kind of sit it out and do your time. But here, and especially if you're going to buck back against the system, and it comes across as kind of arbitrary whether or not they're going to let you go, whether or not they think you're sane. And these are the questions which come in, like, how do you even classify how somebody is sane or insane? And it Nicholson actually, he's got lots of great monologues in this, and one of them, he actually, he puts it across to the other men that how do they define themselves as being any more insane than anybody who's walking around on the street? Because if you remove that from the equation, then kind of just a bunch of weirdos. But what's happened is that the institution has these scientific categories, these boxes that they put people in, and they have determined that this mode of behavior would classify somebody as insane. And so what this brings into question is the nature of institutional control and the way these institutions can designate people as being mad or sane and therefore just leave them incarcerated permanently, which is something which is like more power than like a prison camp.
Yeah, and there's also this other element, and I'm gonna steal a line from, I think it was the movie Shutter Island, that once you've been deemed insane, no matter what you say, everything you say is going to be considered to be part of that insanity. So you, no matter how much you plead that you're not insane, well, they're just not going to listen to you because you've been discredited. You've been deemed a insane person, and then you're no longer this rational. You're no longer this rational person who has agency of their own. Now you're somebody who is a danger. Now you're somebody that the system needs to control, because if they let their hands off. If they let your hands off of you for 1 minute, then you're just going to go mad and you're going to commit all these crimes or something like that. So like deeming somebody insane puts them under the control of a some kind of system, much more so than just putting them behind bars in a prison.
Yeah, and what this leads us into as well is the sort of the Michel Foucault takes, because he did a lot of work. I know he's like this raging leftist sort of degenerate, and he's got a terrible reputation. But unfortunately, a lot of his work and a lot of his studies kind of play into this. And I saved a couple of sort of things to introduce us here. And one of the sort of the dichotomy in the institution would be between the technicians and what he would call docile bodies. And this is just from Wikipedia here. Foucault argues in The Carceral that the least active disobedience is punished, and the best way of avoiding serious offences is to punish the most minor offences very severely. And in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you'll actually see this strange thing where if somebody refuses their medication, they're dealt with like really harshly. Whereas there's a point where Jack Nicholson takes them all out on a boat and they like a mass escape attempt. And then there doesn't seem to be like anywhere near the severity of the sort of the punishment for doing that. And the idea is that if you punish minor offences really harshly, then it means that you almost don't have to have a punishment for major offences because they almost never happen. So here's where you get into the science of control, the psychology of control, and an institution of control. And then it says in the movie they use this technique. The nurses and other people of authority in the film express this technique is because when the patients would act in a wrongful manner, they would forcibly grab them and isolate them from the rest of the patients. Throughout that process, there may have been some smacking. Also in the scene where Cheswick, who's the little kind of, he's quite old in it, he's a bit weak and feeble. Cheswick continuously yelled about his cigarettes. It led to himself, the chief, and McMurphy to receive the electric shock therapy. So it's completely out of the sort of norm. Foucault's argument that power works in a disciplinary way in current society was greatly analysed in this film because it used a psychiatric ward that had nurses and other people of authority who had the power to punish. Having the power to punish and having produced docile bodies are techniques that Foucault would describe as using the disciplinary technique. This is talked about in his The Carceral. So we see here that there's actually the institution and the methods of control are very insidious and very carefully thought out, to the point where there'll be people in the chat saying Nurse Ratched is evil. And you can say, well, yeah, she's definitely vindictive and she definitely seems to enjoy it. But at the same time, is it the system or is it her? Or is it the system which enables people like her? And of course, you can begin to look around at our own kind of system. I mean, we've really jumped in at the heavy stuff straight away, Yali.
Well, yeah, you know, the one thing about her character that grates on me so much are those scenes where they're sitting around in that circle having their what do they call it, like community therapy hour. I can't remember what the phrase I had for it was.
Yeah.
But just like the way that she talks to them in that like kind of passive aggressive, really kind of mellow, really demeaning way, and you know, it just makes you want to get up. It just makes you want to get up and punch her in the face, to be quite honest. But yeah, like, and it does remind me of basically how we're spoken to by the regime today. Like, think about any of these like PR campaigns. Think about what it would be, what it's like to be in diversity training or something like that. It does feel like you're sitting around in one of these circles, you know, where you're, you know, not being treated as an adult or a person with any kind of dignity or agency of your own, having this this tool there basically lecture you and you know, enjoy that the fact that they have power over you.
Yeah, it's literally what I think it's like I've seen it going around like a Bronze Age pervert thing where they call it the longhouse, which relates to some like Viking house, which was ruled by women, and that's where men would become domesticated. And because
I think it's a Native American thing. Is it?
I'm not really fully aware. I kind of get it, what they're going for, and it's as if they're in this longhouse. You'll notice that the wardens are like black men, and then like all of the nurses appear to be female. So you've got like the muscle, and then you've got the actual power is in the hands of like almost exclusively females, except right at the top you've got the sort of the head honcho, like the psychiatrist or the doctor or whatever he is. But then under that you've got all of these like fully grown men being tricked, like being completely emasculated by the system, by the power, as if it's designed to do that. And some of the men have even handed themselves over, like voluntarily, which is something which Jack Nicholson just finds it hard to believe, that men would actually voluntarily, without like trying to escape prison or anything like that, they'd voluntarily hand themselves over to that system. And then also where it'll be up to the system whether they let them leave or not. It's pretty badly. I mean, the institution itself, I don't think it would be like that anymore, because when you get into mental health now, they seem to just allow them to wander the streets.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole new thing that I know that mental health has become something which it's certainly an interesting topic for the present day. Yeah, like you just feel like in the movie, like you just hate that place, especially as a guy. Like you would just think it would be the most it would be a complete nightmare to have to live there. Buck Broken, yeah. Someone wrote that in the chat. So yeah, it is kind of like taming an animal. It's like taking a lion or something like that, and then. And then taming it by, you know, forcing it to do these tricks and chaining it up. And it used to end up with this really like sad, pathetic animal. Yeah. And then the idea of people actually voluntarily going into that and actually being taken in and not going through that because they have to, but going through that because they decided to themselves. I mean, that's being broken on a whole different level, but you know, it also does. It also is reminiscent of many, many things in the present day as well. Like a lot of the things from the system that the system throws at us. I'll go back to the example of the diversity training. You know, you're technically not being forced to sit through it, but you know, if you want to work for the company, you have to sit through it. But you do technically have the ability to get up and to walk away. There isn't really anything that's stopping you from doing that, but I mean, you know, you need to have a job, but at the same time, there are alternatives to that, which, you know, people like you and I have found that neither of us would ever sit through that. But, you know, so many people out there, so many like people like self-respecting white people who should actually have a spine go through with this stuff. And we'll get into this a bit later, but the end of the film is basically about just breaking out and breaking those chains.
It's funny because I was reading, I know this is like going off the subject of the movie, but I was reading quite a lengthy article the day, which I thought was fantastic, which was all about how America, I mean, it is kind of related to the film. I know we always go off on tangents, but it was America as a complex system of complex systems. And his point was that the kind of the fact that everywhere now is forced by law to do diversity hiring, he was comparing it as salt being sort of sprayed onto iron. And what the point that he was making was that there's more and more now you see these random kind of parts of the system breaking down in America. And he was explaining that it's very, very difficult for them to get out of it, because if you do that, you're going to have to change law, and anybody who tries to change the law is going to be called a racist or a fascist or far right or whatever. And so there's this kind of there's something which is incorrect, which has been baked into the system, and now it's spreading throughout the system, and you're going to start and see more parts of the system as a whole beginning to break down. And in a way, you end up with this kind of supersized nut house, where something's not right, but the policies of the Nut House are kind of designed in such a way where you can't rectify the problem. And it's a little bit like if you've got like a man who is not mad in the asylum, then the more, like, say, Jack Nicholson, and then he's going to protest. He's going to say, I'm not mad, and he's going to get angry, and he's going to get frustrated about the fact that he's there. But then, it did happen to him, they're going to say, well, you are aggressive, you are, you're causing trouble, therefore, this is proof that you are actually mad. So the more you protest that you're not mad, the more that they're going to say that you're mad, which is more or less what happened to him. Something similar in Joseph Heller's book, Catch 22, actually, which is mainly about the World War II. But it was the same thing where you would have to be, because the American pilots, according to this, like one of the most cynical books ever written, you can check out the background of the author. His general view, It's fictional. It's a satire, but he was saying that if you imagine the American pilots of World War II, you would have to be insane to want to get into an aeroplane where you're going to be shot down, because it's just not a rational thing to do. And he takes about part patriotism, all of this kind of thing. But then there was a clause added with Catch 22, which was that only insane people would want to do it. So there was no way out. You couldn't get out of doing it at all. You were locked in either way. So the more that you scream that you're sane, the more they're going to say that you're insane. And then the more that you say, well, diversity means that we're having more train crashes, or there's toxic things going into medicines because of incompetence, the more that proves the original premise that the society is racist and bigoted. So you're locked into this in madness writ large.
Yeah, that's what I thought of. I thought of that as well. It's that, if we're going to go with my example, we're comparing the group sessions and really the madhouse in general in the film with a diversity and inclusion seminar in a modern corporation. Yeah, like if you stood up and said anything, if you stepped out of line in the least bit, if you said, you know, I don't really think that I don't really think blacks are that have it that bad off. Well, then that's just that's just proof that of everything that they're saying. So they're now that's just justification for more of the diversity stuff. It means that you haven't been taught it enough, and now we need even more of it. And then much like what happened with Jack Nicholson in the movie, they turn him into this kind of lobotomized vegetable. With this kind of system, if you step out of line, well then you're kind of giving the system it's you're giving them what they want, and that you're allowing them to, well, I should rephrase that. I don't think that stepping out of line is necessarily giving them what they want, but if you're in that context, in the context of being under the control of an HR department, let's just say, by stepping out of line, that just to them justifies their control even more. So the only solution really is to kind of just break free of that, which we'll get into later.
Yeah, there's an interesting quote from the director of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because he was Czech, Milos Forman. And he wrote in 2012, to me, the story was not just literature, but real life. The life I lived in Czechoslovakia from my birth in 1932 until 1968. The Communist Party was my nurse ratchet, telling me what I could and could not do, what I was or was not allowed to say, where I was or was not allowed to go, even when I was not. And he carries on that vein for a little bit there, and where I was not allowed to go, even who I was and who I was not. So it's kind of weird, because I realize that people will kind of cringe a little bit when you hear like people, the sort of comparisons to a society of control, because you could say, well, look at the West, everybody's got too much freedom and all of this. There's a bit of boomerism. There's a kind of, it smacks of a sort of normie-con talking point when you start and draw parallels to communism. But what I think it leads to is something interesting, because In One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, obviously you've got Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson was also the star of Easy Rider, which is, like, in my view, the boomer sort of standard of movies and attitude generally. And in that, Jack Nicholson, he's kind of like the third party. He tags along with them for a bit, and I think he's like a small town lawyer. I haven't watched it for a long time for obvious reasons. And then they get attacked by a bunch of hillbillies in the middle of the night, and he gets his head stoved in. But the idea that I got from it was that he comes from this conservative small town, and the two, Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda, are kind of liberating them and taking them on their journey, their boomer bike journey of discovering sort of the heart of America, you know, freedom forever on the road, smoking pot, and the general whole kind of hippie thing. And so it's funny that Jack Nicholson was in that. And then in what would have been like 7 years later, I think Easy Rider was 60, came out 68, 69. It was like real peak baby boomer type thing, hippie thing. And so when you fast forward and you get into the 70s, it also just his age adds up nicely as well. So when you get into the 70s, we've spoke about this before, where you get this really kind of dour, sort of depressing movies coming out. And I would say that One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest is one of them as well. So here we got Jack Nicholson again, but now he's not... It's like the opposite. Now he's still of the boomer generation, but instead of being this free floating spirit on the back of a bike and smoking dope under the stars, he's in a nut house. And it reflects what happened with the boomers, where they want to take on the system, they want to break the system apart, they want to be in rebellion. And then in the 70s, they actually enter the institutions, they begin careers. And they're kind of absorbed into the system. So it's almost like a kind of meta commentary on the arc of the boomers themselves. I mean, somebody in the chat or somewhere when I posted this said One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest is like the quintessential boomer movie. I would say Easy Rider is, but I do take the point, because One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest is like sort of catching up with the boomers. In the 70s, the system was just as powerful as ever, and they'd been absorbed into it. And so it's almost like, and you begin to see this kind of depression, this big hangover setting in. So Jack Nicholson is there as the archetype of the boomer, and he's now within this system of control, trying to stoke up rebellion and trying to sort of free the spirits of the kind of crushed book broken men within it. You can see it in his sort of attitudes to the chief, the big Indian as well, where he kind of recognizes that, like, it was a running thing, I think, where it would be recognized that the Native American Indians were kind of twin spirits, that there was a sort of kinship there, because they were also in shackled to the system of control, which was like civilization itself. And you see that reflected in the in One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest with the chief and Jack Nicholson, who he's obviously most friendly to and most respectful to out of everybody in the movie as well.
Yeah, it's important to note, in case anybody hasn't seen the film. So the character of the chief, basically for the first almost two-thirds of the movie, he's not even really a character. He's just a guy kind of in the background. So they have their main group of guys that go through their therapy session. And what everybody thinks the chief is, they just think he's like this. He's just brain dead. So he's completely silent. He doesn't react to anything. He's just standing there with a mop, pushing it back and forth over the same like 2 meters of ground. And basically, like, they think that he's a vegetable. He can't hear, he can't speak, he doesn't understand anything. But then towards the end of the movie, so basically Jack Nicholson gets into a fight with one of those guards, and the chief picks the guard up and throws him across the room. After that scene, Jack Nicholson figures out that the chief is actually faking it. So he actually is a perfectly functional, sane person. But he's been faking being insane, for the entire time. Just like how Jack Nicholson was faking being insane to get out of the regular prison, but the chief is going a lot further with it, in that he's not even talking anymore. He's not showing any kinds of emotions. He's just standing in the corner with a broom doing nothing until he finally gains the fortitude to actually do something about it. So that is an interesting aspect of the film, that the chief is a character that is just so broken that he's going to confine himself to just standing in the corner for the rest of his life, pushing a broom back and forth and around a bunch of people who don't even think that he has the mental capacity to figure out who his own name or anything like that. So that's a whole nother level of being under control. One thing you mentioned earlier is like with the analogy to communism and how that kind of has become cringe. I mean, I think that I see where some people are going with that, that they'll say things that, like a take that you often hear on the dissident right is that, well, it's cringe to say that the current system today is communism because, well, look at all the consumerism and look at all the individual, this individualism and selfishness and materialism. But, you know, I think that on a deeper level, the take really actually isn't that incorrect. If we actually look at like something that's much deeper with communism and with the system today, there's these systems that are founded upon lies, and they just have these like these false narratives which justify absolute control over everything, and they engage in things like we see in the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where they have to always uphold the idea that in present day, society is racist and we have to do everything we can to undo white supremacy. So we need to have these seminars. And, you know, if you dare say anything about this, well, you know, you're just part of the problem. I imagine that it would have been really similar for the director. I forgot what his name was, that you mentioned earlier, that he mentioned that living through communism was like that with him. I'm currently reading the book Heart of a Dog, which was written in the 1920s by Mikhail Bulgakov, and it's basically a parody of communism. He wrote this in the 1920s, just after a few years after the revolution. And one thing that stood out to me so far in the book is like all these committees, all of these like these like busybodies who now have been given some kind of role to go around and to enforce the system, and you know the way that they harass people and. It's all just really reminiscent of what you see going on in the film. So I don't think that the take necessarily is like too boomerish. No, I do see the critique of the film as being a quintessentially boomer film of bucking the system and being a rebel and kind of never growing up. But I still think though that there can be some positives drawn from that because. Are people today really living like that? I don't really think they are. I don't think that people really are living like that these days. You know, if they have their vacation in India or something like that, where they go on their like spiritual journey, or they went to Woodstock or something like that when they were young. I don't think that people really are living that kind of life. It's more of a very artificial kind of freedom. So you have, you can choose to be a fan of this rock group or this rap group. You can choose to be a fan of Star Wars or be a fan of Harry Potter. But ultimately, the kind of like actual the freedom or what's considered freedom today really is super. It really is superficial, and I really don't think we have much freedom at all.
Yeah, I mean, the Adam Curtis documentary, The Century of the Self, charts all of this from the Cultural Revolution in the 60s through like moving into the institutions And then that kind of zest for freedom would then be funneled into consumerism, but not in the way that it was in the 50s, where it was kind of family orientated. You think of the washing machine and this. When they got underway in the 70s, it would be more on an individual level. So you express your individuality through the consumer items that you bought. And if you don't want to go along with that, like, this is where you get into this trap, and it's kind of similar to what we were talking about before, because the horrible thing about that is that if, let's just fast forward a little bit to the 90s, or maybe it would be the Rolling Stones, like the saying something like Nirvana, if like Kurt Cobain, Nirvana would sing songs about how crap modern life was, and that they didn't want to fully fit into the system. They were anti-system, just like the boomers. I think the difference with the boomers would be that Kurt Cobain was conscious of, say, the commodification of everything. And you see this in some of the songs. But what this was, and this is what Kurt has pointed out, that the more you rebel against the system, the more you're going to fall into, like, that itself, the rebellion will be commodified. So what ends up is you wear a T-shirt which will say something like, fuck the system, or some kind of pithy political comment, but the T-shirts being made in Malaysia and then sold for $15 and being imported by the millions. So everybody ends up walking around with a T-shirt which says, fuck the system. But they've all paid for it. They've all, they've kind of reinforced the slavery. Which is, I mean, Nirvana,
you know,
had...
I actually have a great example of that. Would you like to finish your thought, or would you like me to give that?
I was just going to say, I mean, I think the Nirvana had like a song which was called Radio Friendly Unit Shifter. And in it, he really is, like, you can see he's going to top himself. You can see he's really close to the edge. I wouldn't romanticize Kurt Cobain that much in this vein, because he was a bit of a degenerate. You can imagine what he would be like if he was alive today. But still, just the idea that you can have a song called Radio Friendly Unit Shifter, where it's as far out there in terms of just screaming and being in this kind of mode of pain. He's conscious of it. He can't get out of the trap. And they're going to just sell it by the bucket load, make a ton of money. There was no way out.
Yeah, you know, there was this perfect example of this, which I came across. I think it was in 2021. So I know that we all remember in 2020 when there were the BLM riots. And in, I think the city was Bristol in the UK. Was that the one where they knocked over that statue?
Yeah.
Of Edward Colston, was it, right?
Yeah.
So everyone who knows this art, the artist Banksy, who was supposed to be this secret artist. No one knows his identity, but he makes these paintings and they show up on buildings, and wow, he's such a rebel. Well, they had this shirt that was, I think, made and sold by the Banksy of it said Bristol, and it had a picture of the knocking over Colston statue. And there was this picture of these three, I'd say, you know, early 20s, maybe late 20s, like Gen Z millennial types, holding these T-shirts, which cost £30 each, wearing masks from the pandemic in this picture. And I just thought it was so symbolic, because it's the fake rebellion. It's the fake rebellion, whereas they're fully under the control of the actual system. Like the symbology of BLM, we all know that's fake. It's AstroTurf. It's fake rebellion. It's being facilitated by the elites. We all know that. And then Banksy is another media creation. He's a garbage artist. None of the stuff he does is good. And he's a media creation as well. He's just been built up by the system as, whoa, look at this rebel. Look at how edgy he is. And then they're selling this shirt for like £30 or some outrageous amount like that. And they're holding up these shirts while wearing the mask, which back in those days was like the symbol of compliance to the system. And I just found that like so symbolic of the fake freedom that the fake rebellion that's kind of been sold to us over the last couple decades versus the very real system of control, which we're actually living under now.
I mean, a lot of what One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest is about in terms of like a society of control is where everything is. The obvious reference here would be the pandemic. But where if you look at how it functions and how it works, everybody has to go at this to like everybody has to sit in a certain place. They go for their medication at a certain time. They use that horrible sort of Aga Bilk style music that they've got on, which they have to listen to, which Jack Nicholson once turned off. But then, there's a whole thing to get in with the sham democracy that they go on. Just to get into that a little bit, where it's about the World Series, and obviously you've got people in there who are complete vegetables, and Jack Nicholson says, "I want the music off, and I want the World Series on, at least on the radio." And Nurse Ratched is like, "No, she doesn't want, she just won't have it." So then he proposes a vote. And of course, what happens is he goes around. There's a couple of attempts, and on the second attempt, he gets just enough votes. But then she says the last vote came in after the group therapy time was up, so therefore it's void. And all of a sudden, you begin to see that it's like using it's unbelievably sort of strict towards the bureaucratic, these tiny, stupid little rules. It was obvious that most of the men just wanted to listen to the World Series, but she could draw in, she could kind of fiddle around with the power that she's got and invoke some stupid little nitpicky thing to make sure that they didn't get their way. And because what she understood was that if she... her power would be undermined if Jack Nicholson, in a way, Jack Nicholson was kind of creating a populist rebellion against the authority figure. So if he had got his way, it would have kind of been like the equivalent of Donald Trump getting into office or something like that. It was like you could draw that analogy on when you think of like if they got their own guy in charge and then all of the nurses and the wardens just refused to help, but in this case, it was just, well, your vote doesn't matter because of this nitpick. Brexit again comes to mind. But what we're really talking about is the way the patients are socialized, which just slowly but surely breaks down their will. It breaks down all of their critical faculties. You have to be here at this time. You have to go to bed at this time. And this is actually how the society functions. And what I think is interesting about that is it's when you get the sort of normicon right wing takes, it is like about this kind of conforming to the machine. And now, as we discussed with, say, the diversity quotas, it's a machine which hates us. A few decades ago, I would have regarded these kinds of things about the freedom and whatnot as being a bit kind of cringe, a bit kind of dated. But I've become sympathetic. As I understand it, in the book of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I think it's narrated by the chief, the Indian. And in the movie, he talks about how he watched his father and the alcohol steadily just sort of ate away at him. He was a really huge, powerful man, but he was also a drunkard. It was a problem with our community. And then eventually it was like, well, the alcohol just ate him away until there was nothing left. And he said to Jack Nicholson, "This is what they're doing to you. They're breaking you down. They're just bit by bit, rule by rule, regulation by regulation. They're just breaking you down like a death by a thousand cuts." Because Jack Nicholson assumed that his kind of high energy and charisma would win through. And it was like, no, they're playing the long game. And they will win. They will break you down in the end. And in the book, I think the Indian, he talks about the Combine. And the Combine is this giant system of control in itself, which he's kind of accepted his lot within it. I think the idea is he can internally be free, whereas Jack Nicholson's obviously an extrovert and he wants the world. He wants to use his wits and his funny, he's in it, to kind of get everybody to express themselves and freedom. And it is like a typical kind of boomer thing. But what's interesting is that they've created, you know, I don't want to place all of the blame on them, but in the end, if you go back to the civil rights law, and what we're living under now, which is this kind of soft police totalitarian system where sort of your bigotry and prejudice against white people is just baked into the system at every turn, as we discussed before, then it's kind of like it's hard not to want to break free from that. It's hard not to see that you're living under this combine, which is gradually just gnawing away at you and kind of breaking you down bit by bit. And I don't think it's kind of necessarily this inherently cringe thing. I just think it's kind of tragic that this vision of freedom ended up like that, because it does create in America, and then we copied it with the Equalities Act. Do you see what I mean?
Well, yeah, and I actually, what I wanted to say was that I don't think we should be taking the enemy's framing on the issue of what freedom means, because the way that it's been sold to us, what we've been told is that it means like having the right to be to be transgendered and be a degenerate or I don't know, it means like rights for like minorities or whatever it is. But really, what has happened is that they've kind of they've stolen the definition of freedom, and that for many of us, we might say today, well, we don't want the LGBT stuff. We don't want the diversity stuff. But I think deep down, though, that really isn't, it isn't really freedom. What they're pushing as what has been pushed for the last several decades as being making a country free. Like I if you ever see these studies, they'll have like the Freedom House Index, where it says like which country is the freest. Have you ever seen any of those?
Yeah, and countries like Sweden always top it.
Yeah, well, a country like Ireland was named the freest and most democratic. It was, or at least it was near the top. I mean, the country Ireland has just implemented this speech law, which is extremely draconian. You can watch Keith Wood's video about it, but it even has incredible things like the assumption of guilt and things like that. That if you have what's deemed to be hate material on your device, well, then it's you have the burden of proof to prove that you didn't intend it for hate or something crazy like that. The entire concept of freedom has just been completely distorted. Think about something like the Civil Rights Act, which came in in the 1960s. That is like when you think of what it actually means for society and the rules that you have to follow. Like there is this great meme of it was saying James Lindsay's 80,000 point plan for ending wokeness, and it had Dr. Manhattan just evaporating. I think it was some character in Watchmen, but it said, "Here's the Civil Rights Act doing this to James Lindsay's plan," because basically what this thing does is it makes wokeism mandatory by law. Like think about. You know, what they do is they show you things that they'll show you the old pictures from the 50s and 60s and say, well, look how badly black people were treated back then. You know, we don't want to go back to that. Are you saying that you support this? Well, you must be a really horrible person. You know, I look at this picture of the KKK or something like that. But when you consider things like it, you can get sued for not having like a good enough diversity balance, or even things like, for example, there are lots of examples of things like disparate impact, how what was it again? It was something about firefighters that they had to drop the requirements for being a firefighter, because I think they had like an IQ test or something like that, and they had to drop this IQ test because not enough black people were able to pass the IQ test for being a firefighter. Or there was another one about education, that they had to get rid of the requirements of having a high school education because there weren't enough black people who had a high school education. And then It made them less likely to be able to attain that job. And just when you think of all of the implications that something like the Civil Rights Act has on society, and all the burdens it places upon you, and all the legal downfalls that all like the legal traps it puts you in, and basically it makes you, if you're going to be somebody who if you own a business or anything like that, you're going to be walking on eggshells for your entire life, trying not to violate something like that. And now every other Western country has their own equivalent of the same thing. Like, that is not freedom. That's control on a whole new level. And you know, the fake rebellion, the fake idea of freedom that's kind of been pushed on us. Really what we need to do is to break free from the current system that of control that you, like you mentioned, it hates us. And the other example I wanted to bring up was the pandemic, which is obvious. Now, everyone would know that, like, that was a horrible 2 years, you know, being told where you can sit in a restaurant, what time you're allowed to go to the store, what you're allowed to buy from the store. Obviously, it's horrible. But I feel like we haven't really gone back to where it was in 2019, because there has been this kind of cultural shift that has gone on in that time, that things which would have been considered just someone's own personal responsibility are now being regulated a lot more. Now, I don't know for a fact whether this wouldn't have happened a few years ago, but I remember last year during the summer in France, in some region in France somewhere. I know this is an obscure example, but there was a day that was like going to be really hot, and then they banned public events for that day because it was too hot outside. And, you know, I really just thought that, you know, wouldn't it have just been, wouldn't we have just assumed a few years ago that if the weather was hot, it would be your choice whether you wanted to go outside or not? But now we kind of have this system that it's, well, you know, it's going to be dangerous for people. So, well, should we be allowing them to go outside when the weather's hot? Well, I think we shouldn't, because, I mean, you know, it is their personal choice, but they are going to be harming themselves. And it feels like there's this big shift in that direction. And you can look further back with things like mandatory seatbelts or mandatory helmets. Now, look, I wear a seatbelt in a car, but, you know, you can kind of see that, like, our lives are being more and more regulated.
The smoking ban as well, which completely changed how you go to the pub. But I mean, the example with France is just it's a perfect example of the one flew over the cuckoo's nest, where you've got these technicians. I mean, one of the things when there's any kind of scrutiny comes under Nurse Ratched, whether they meet with the board and they talk, well, she's got 15 years and her record is impeccable. And that is absolutely going to be the case. But the problem is, like, it's because she's working for an evil system. And in the same way, when you bring in something like, and what happens is they've got the technicians and the experts as authority figures, which is just completely crushing the human spirit, because the foundations of the way they look at the world is wrong. And even when you bring in something like the case with Ireland with the hate speech laws or whatever, and you say, well, this isn't freedom, well, they would say that it is. They would say that because they talk about liberty and liberation and freedom all of the time. And they would say that having their special interest groups put into positions of power was like that is about giving these people an equal amount of opportunities and freedom as, say, white males or whatever. So you've got this kind of anti-logic built into it. This madness. The lunatics are running the asylum. The system's foundational ideas are wrong, and so then everything that it adds on just takes us more and more into the realms of lunacy. And this fella's article that I was reading today was pointing out where strange things are beginning to happen in America, where there was some kind of eye drops or something. It went into the market and people were buying it and they were using it. And like 14 people went blind and there was a few kids died. And apparently it had the wrong, like, the mix. There'll be chemicals which go in there, but then they're sort of like they got the quality control is wrong, and this is what he's talking about, the system of systems. It's the same, you know, if you'll see, for example, trains are crashing more and more now. And one of the reasons is there's lots of reasons for it. That's the whole problem. It's becoming endemic. It's as if the whole sort of superstructure is just rusting and rotting away. And so one thing you can see is, for example, if you imagine that in a steel foundry somewhere, the actual rail tracks are being forged, are they going to have to go through some kind of quality control? Now, it may well be that the person who forged it, all the quality control is not there through merit, but because they're a diversity hire. Nevertheless, that then goes out onto the train track. It becomes a train track, and then a train carrying 50,000 litres of acetone crashes, and you've got one hell of a mess, which is possibly what happened with them in Ohio, East Palestine, or I haven't followed the story, so I'm just saying that that could have been the reason. And the point is, you see more and more of these things happening, but you can't actually point to the root cause of it without ending up into the sort of Jack Nicholson role of being seen as a maniac and a lunatic. The more that you point it out, the more that they're going to say you're a lunatic. And which then reinforces the problem in the first place, because they'll say the society's racist and all of this. So it's kind of like we're just stuck.
Yeah, and you know, that brings me on to another thing I wanted to bring up, was that kind of these like psychological sessions in the film where Nurse Ratched is saying to them like, well, you really should be quiet, or you really need to be taking your medication, or you know, these scenes, which are, you know, really the meat of the movie. It really reminds me of Sigmund Freud and of what's it called, psychoanalysis, and it just how like bullshit the entire thing is. And it's just this kind of like gaslighting you into thinking that there's something wrong with you by saying, well, you know, the reason you feel that way, it's because there really is something wrong with you. So, you know, you might have a happy family, you know, like this is the kind of things that Sigmund Freud and his offshoots would say. They'd say like, well, you know, you might have it might appear like you have a happy family, but deep down, your father is actually a tyrannical abuser, and you actually want revenge on him. It's just in your deep subconsciousness that you don't know it. And, you know, it's like putting these ideas in your head. It's like putting these ideas in your head. I should also point out that everything you'd need to know about psychoanalysis and Sigmund Freud, you can read that. You can read about it in Kevin MacDonald's book. Hopefully that's YouTube friendly. But the point I wanted to make is that a lot of the stuff that we see today, they kind of employ these same tactics too. So what they'll say to you is that, well, you know, if you're against diversity, well, you know, you're just like you're just a bigot. You're just somebody who's uneducated. You're somebody who is, or you're somebody who's angry about other people having an opportunity. Another line that shitlibs like to bring out, they say, well, if you become used to privilege, equality feels like oppression to you. You know, they have all these kind of like psychoanalysis, Freudian, like bullshit science that they kind of try to pull on you to psychologize you into telling you that there is something wrong with you for opposing the system, when in reality, it's the system itself. But unfortunately, it works on the weak-minded. So like you see in the movie, where there's all these guys who aren't actually insane, they're not going to go and kill someone. They're all voluntarily in this madhouse, in this asylum. They've been broken by the system. And they have this woman, Nurse Ratched, who's able to convince them that there is something wrong with them. You see, and then you would see that with somebody like with something like psychoanalysis, it works on the weak-minded, because somebody who's not confident in themselves, somebody who doesn't have self-confidence, they're going to think, well, maybe I actually am. Maybe my father actually was a tyrant. Maybe I actually am sexually repressed, which is, you know, Freud talked all about that, like that. Oh, well, if you're, you know, if you're angry, if you like love your nation or something like that, if you love your culture and you don't want it to be tarnished, well, you're actually sexually repressed. And that's actually your negative energy making you feel that way. you know, it, for somebody who doesn't have the fortitude and self-confidence to stand up for themselves, it is very effective against them. And you see that both in the present world today and in the film.
Yeah, I mean, it lines up perfectly with another sort of big-brained quote, because there's a lot of analysis being done on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and the way of institutions and power and systems of control, which you might expect. And there's one of them here, and he says, by emphasizing the conflict between nurse and free-spirited patient, Casey, who wrote the book, thus reinforces his idea that people often fall victim to a tug of war between societal expectations and personal needs. Ratchet demands an unquestioning acceptance of societal standards, punishing patients who challenge the daily flow of activities on her ward. By contrast, McMurphy reminds his peers that they all have personalities and inner lives, encouraging them to laugh in the face of authority whenever possible. Caught between the poles of Ratchet's demands and McMurphy's free-spirited philosophy, Casey's minor characters show how difficult it is to be oneself in a harsh, homogenous world. He means conforming there, not in an ethnic sense. McMurphy's spirit rejuvenates them, but Ratchet's looming presence repeatedly crushes their hopes. And this is what I kind of wanted to touch on as well, because we can think of the sort of... You've got Nurse Ratchet, and then you've got Jack Nicholson. And this is why I wanted to kind of get over this sort of, or let's just attack the boomers all of the time. Because from the perspective of the system in this day and age, which is also a problem that I find with the normie comms, because they think they are like of the system, and they're not. They are on the outside of it. The people, really, the spirit of the system is people like Vouch or ContraPoints or what you call that AOC, Alicia Cortez, and all of these people. These are the kind of these are the ratchets and the wardens of the system. The normie cons, normal people are on the outside of it. But then, of course, you're going to have people who are kind of rebellious, people who are politically incorrect or saying the wrong things or, you know, debunking the narrative or debunking the lies or, you know, breaking the taboos of the system. And so what we see in the real world is really similar to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because, I mean, it literally happens where Jack Nicholson is just completely exasperated with the other men because they are like normies, because they don't know which way to go. They feel it in their gut that Jack Nicholson is correct. They feel it that he is going to lead them to kind of freedom and self-actualization, but they're scared of the consequences. So this is why it's just like such a powerful film, I think, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because we are today completely governed by Nurse Ratchet, like quite literally. Like, you know, they could have had a man there. They could have had a man in that role, but they didn't. The Nurse Ratchet archetype means that the feminine has been like wafted up into this authority figure within a system, and she can use the bureaucracy of the system in this kind of sadistic way to punish men. And then when you've got somebody who stands up against the system, he's seen as a lunatic. I mean, I got into a bit of a Twitter spat yesterday with a faded celebrity in Britain called Terry Christian, because there's a fella called Steve Laws who does a lot of good work on the immigrants coming in across the channel and whatnot, and just generally about the situation with all of this. And Terry Christian was calling him like crazy and lunatic. But at the same time, like the shit libs in Britain, they also call that, just say the man who did the event last week, it's going to be hot on YouTube, there was a horrible event happened in England last week by a gentleman from abroad, I'll put it that way. So what they're doing, they're saying that he had mental health issues, and that's why he did this horrible thing. But they're saying it in a way to diffuse a political sort of aspect to it. I mean, my view is that all crimes committed by people from abroad who come here or they are all political, because the only reason they are here in the first place is political decisions and policies by politicians. So there's no such thing as a political free crime. You know, it's all political. But what they're doing is bringing in this thing where a random sort of stabbing spree on the streets where people are murdered, that then is always ascribed to a mental health. And because it takes away, because it gets kicked into the long grass of mental health policies of the government, are we doing enough? Is there enough institutions? Are people getting enough care? Meanwhile, the so-called far right, they are also pathologized, but then there's also like this moral thing attached to it. So all of a sudden, at the same time, the same people will have its mental health issues, and it isn't a question of politics or morality. And then when it comes to the far right, it's mental health issues and it's evil and demonic. Like, at the same time, they will do that. Like, literally at the same time, they'll do that. And I also have long had a problem with psychiatry in general, because there comes a point when you've got to admit that the system is evil. You know, I did one of my first ever videos was because I've known quite a few fellas who've committed suicide. It seems to go up each year. And a few of them actually have tried to get help. And when that happens, it's kind of framed in such a way where they are the problem. So if they say, my life feels meaningless, I've got this crummy job, I'm just not happy, I just expected more from life and I'm not getting it, then the system won't actually be brought in under any kind of criticism. They will just like pump him full of pills and send him on his way, because there's no, but the question is, what happens if the men are actually sane, you know, like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? What happens if the men who are unhappy are actually the same ones, and it's the people who are perfectly content in this society who are actually mad? Well, they can't go there, because that would lead to such a root and branch change of how we live that it can't be allowed. So what they do is then just pump everybody full of drugs, and they individualize the problem. Society can't be, society isn't the problem, you are. And this is, there's no way out for them. They'll go off and hang themselves or whatever.
Yeah. Although I would say that it's worth pointing out that the more radically liberal or to the left somebody is, the more likely they are to either suffer from mental health issues or report being unhappy. So even they're not actually even happy in this system either. So it's kind of just a catch-all that it really makes nobody happy. One thing you pointed out earlier about the event that that took place in England a few days ago, because I saw your tweet. I don't really use Twitter that much, but I every now and then I just went on to check to post the stream a few days ago, and I saw the one that you tweeted that the news, some newspaper or something, they released a photo like saying that like some stabbing suspect has been arrested, and then the photo they used, you noted it, like it looked like the hand of a 15-year-old white woman, a white girl, when it was in fact somebody of a different ethnic background that and a male, of course, that committed the attack. But then another thing that you'll notice with these people is that, and this also happened in France as well, after another similar tragic event happened in France a couple of weeks ago. The mayor of this town, who was also a foreigner, also not actually ethnically French himself, I think he was also of the same background as the guy who committed the stabbing. I think that he was also an Arab, but he said that we can't allow this event to be used by the far right to sow division in our communities, and that we have to recommit ourselves to diversity. And with this, the family in England, the family of the woman who was whose family had been killed by this knife attacker, she even said something like, "We can't. We must denounce racism." And they like if you want an idea of how much control this system really has over the minds of people, and really the kind of situation that we're in, they were able to get, now I don't know all the details about it, so I'm just going on based on what I heard, but they were able to get this woman who just had her family murdered, like brutally murdered by someone stabbing them with a knife, and they can still get her to go out and then claim that diversity is great. And that we can't, and we can't, and that we can't see race, and that it has nothing to do with it. And well, you know what all that implies is that the people that would point out this glaring issue that would point out that, look, Western society has imported people from the third world, and this is the reason why we have these horrific events which happen more and more often these days. What this kind of morality implies is that it's morally worse to point that out than it actually is to commit the actual heinous crime to begin with.
Yeah, it's worse because, I mean, there's an article which has been going around from the Middle Eastern Eye, and I did a video on it. It was one of my older videos where, I mean, I'm not saying this, I'm not saying this is what's happened in this particular case. But the government have got NGOs, they've got PR departments, and they've got contingency plans. So if let's just say there was some kind of massive event happened in London, where lots of people are dead, and it was a terrorist, or it was to do with crime. It wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just like an electrical fault or something. When then the government have actually got, more than likely, they have got contingency plans to cover that. Not so much in, yeah, don't look back in anger was the classic, someone said in the chat. Not so much in how you deal with the emergency itself. That obviously, they're going to have the firemen are going to be trained, the police are going to know what to do and what areas to go. That's fair enough, we get that. But what they've also got in place are contingency plans about how to manage the public perception. It's called controlled spontaneity. So the idea is that you look, the public have to be told how to think about a certain event. They can't be allowed the agency because they'll come to the wrong conclusions. If you see somebody who's been let into the country because of the government's policies murder a bunch of native people on the streets, hey, you know what? You might get bad ideas from that. And so what they have to do is hijack the sentiment and redirect it so that it flows back into the system itself. And so this is why you see candlelight vigils and you see tolerance, not hate, and all of this kind of slogans which come out. And what the system's doing is offering a form of catharsis to the masses, which it's created itself and which won't cause it any trouble. This raises all kinds of questions because if the mass are not allowed any kind of agency at all, then what kind of a democracy is that? What kind of liberal democratic system is it when the reactions and the emotions of the masses are staged and manipulated and coordinated by the managerial class and the technocrats? Like it's just absurd. It's completely absurd and sick.
It's the kind of democracy that Nurse Ratched was running on voting on whether or not they're going to watch the World Series. That's the kind of democracy it really is. Where half of the people who are supposed to be voting are actually like just vegetables who don't even understand what's going on at all.
Yeah, because the danger is a McMurphy kind of figure will stand up against the system and say, this is all bullshit. We know what you're doing. And so the system will react by all of these different insidious little ways until in the end, I mean, you know, you saw with Fenlong Shanks a few weeks ago, you went to jail for 2.5 years for having an edgy podcast in a system which prides itself on freedom. He got the equivalent of like being euthanized, being lobotomized. I mean, just to get back on the because this is why I find One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest so fascinating. Is the way that technocrats can justify doing horrible things but with a smiley face. And that's exactly what Nurse Ratched is. You can see that passive aggressive smiling look on her face, where even when she drives the young fella who's just popped his cherry, she drives him, she taunts him, she crosses the line there. And it is revealed at the end that actually she is vindictive, because that it isn't that she's just following the rules. It isn't just that she's this kind of tentacle of a bureaucratic system, but that she is conscious of what she's doing and she takes pleasure in it. There's little hints. And then when she taunts Billy about how she's going to tell his mother about he's been with a prostitute, it's, and he kind of relapses. He starts stuttering again, because Jack Nicholson had given him confidence, you know, told him how to be a proper young lad. And then he just goes back in on some. So the exact opposite of what her job is, which should be to cure these people. And it's nothing of the sort. It's to keep them in chain. It's to keep them tormented. And this is why I think it's such a good film, because you see that this is exactly what we're living under. Because people were saying in the chat before it started, like, I don't really see these kind of, how much there's many, much like politics in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. There really is. There really is. It really does say a lot about the system of control, nigh on perfectly. And what I wanted to touch on there was that you can see that the kind of the technocratic mindset can justify doing horrible things through procedure. So at the end of the day, they kind of just murdered Jack Nicholson. I know he wasn't technically dead, but he was brain dead. And they lobotomized him, essentially, and they knew that was going to happen. They did it on purpose, and they would justify that by saying that he is out of control. He is maybe the greater good. He's a danger to himself and to others. This is the safest, most humane option, which it clearly isn't. They've lobotomized and turned into a cabbage a man that was full of life and full of zest, but they've done so through procedure. They've done so through the technocratic rule set, which they follow. And when you sort of go through the implications of that and a lot of the things that we're seeing happening in the world, it becomes really horrifying. You can see elements of it with the sort of the transgender issue, for example. You can see it with the path to life or path to death thing in Canada. It's popping up everywhere now.
Yeah, and then what you mentioned, like putting a smiling face on it all the regime's propaganda, it's all like, it's literally just rainbows everywhere, you know, rainbows and smiling faces and that like awful people of flat design. And, you know, they cover it all with this kind of like overly happy, overly excited kind of facade. But yeah, right underneath it, it's really, really quite, really quite horrifying. When you're saying that, I thought of the same thing. Like in Canada now, they're basically in the process of greatly reducing the requirements it would take for somebody to be given euthanasia. Could it just be that like somebody in the future, you know, when you get somebody who's slightly depressed, they just say, oh well, you know, here's your suicide booth from Futurama. Did you ever see that from Futurama? They had that. I think it was in the first episode.
But, no, I never watched it.
Okay, so like, I think it was in the first episode. But basically, the idea was that in the year 3000, they had created something called a suicide booth. That if you were depressed, you just walked in and killed yourself. Well, you know, it's not gonna. It doesn't at this rate. It's not gonna take us to the year 3000 to get there. But I guess like the other thing about the ending of the film. So what happens at the end is that. Jack Nicholson and the chief are going to break free, but then they've just lobotomized Jack Nicholson. So he's now McMurphy is his name. So McMurphy has just been lobotomized, and now he's just a vegetable. So what the chief does is like he realizes that, you know, this man who was once full of life has now been he's now dead in every way other than his physical body. So his physical body's still breathing, but his soul is gone for good. And the chief actually suffocates him in his bed, and then he breaks through the window and escapes. And the last scene is of him running off into the distance. You know, I thought of one thing you had said earlier, like they're all sitting around in the circle, and they're all just taking the abuse of Nurse Ratched, and a lot of them are just there by their own free will. And Jack Nicholson is just there, like, wondering how can anybody actually take that? How do you not stand up for yourself? How do you just sit there and take it? You know, I've thought about this for a lot in my own life and in the lives of many people. You think, like, going back to the example of diversity training, I just wonder, like, how can any self-respecting white man actually sit through that diversity training? And like, how can you sell your soul? How can you sell your dignity and your self-respect in such a way? But then, you know, the reason they do it is because they need their job. They need to have their, pay their bills. They need to have this job so that they can afford all the gadgets that go with modern life. But you know, for the path that I followed is I actually went to, I studied business in university, and I was lined up for a corporate life, but I chose a different path because I just thought, you know, I might not make as much money if I choose this path, this alternative path, but, you know, I'd actually have my self-respect. And I just decided, I said to myself, I'll never sit through that diversity training. I'm never going to go through that that hell. I'm never going to, like, you know, go into one of these corporations and have to have HR breathing down the back of my neck, and that I have to live every day in fear that some lesbian's going to get angry at me and I get fired. And I chose a different path, and I know that you've done the same as well. And that really is finding that freedom that the movie is referring to. It's by, you know, by breaking out of the system and, you know, finding your own self-respect, gaining some fortitude, and actually going off and being free. That's what I think. That's how I interpreted the end of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in countless shit factory jobs and whatnot, and seen where the procedure and where you have to walk, there's a bell goes off for your dinner and all of this. Now, you can say that you have to have that because you're in an environment which needs discipline and you need efficiency. And yeah, I get it. But it has another effect on the human spirit, where it does just, as the chief said, it just kind of wears you down. It's just kind of breaking down your spirit. And on the touch of the end of the movie there, you know, it's all about that water fountain. The water fountain is, they've got cages on the windows, and Jack Nicholson makes a big sort of show, as if to say, I'm going to lift that up and I'm going to throw it through that window and I'm going to run off to freedom. And all of the other men, like, they could just help him. You kind of expect this scene where he leads the way, and then the other men will, like, one by one, they go over and help him out. That would have been, like, a nice kind of sort of Hollywood happy thing. It would have been a short film, like. But, I mean, you know, you can imagine where one by one the men find it in themselves. You've got one man who leads the way, sticks his head up above the parapet. He's got individualism. He's got agency. And then the other men go over and help him pick it up, and they all escape. And that's not what happens. In fact, they just kind of laugh and sneer at him because he is an alpha. He is, like, sticking his head up. He is an individual against the system, and they sneer and laugh at him again, like, is as a study of the normie. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, just for that alone, is fascinating. And of course, at the very end of the movie, the chief kills him, and then the chief goes back and he picks up the water fountain all alone and just slams it through the cage, and then he runs off. And so it seems to be that he's big enough and strong enough that he can do it all on his own. So it's this kind of final ode to the individual will, the individual freedom, I would once upon a time have kind of sneered at that, but I get it more and more, you know, because especially after the pandemic, and I try not to do it. I try not to jump on constantly kind of complaining about the normie masses. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult. And what kind of leads you is in a sort of return to appreciating individualism a bit more. When you realize that there's the idea of a mass revolt or a mass rebellion is probably pie in the sky. And it's difficult for people, and people disagree with that kind of assumption. And I get it; it's an ongoing discussion.
Well, yeah, and another thing to point out about that scene with the water fountain—the first one—not only do they not help him, they actually like bet him that he's not going to be able to pick up the water fountain and throw it through the window, because he says like, "I'll bet you that I can do it," and of course he can't. So not only are they not going to help him, they're even like going to make a bet that he can't do it. Another thing, another detail is that in the first time that they, because they do try to escape earlier. So they get these two, the two prostitutes, I think they are, to lure one of the guys working there to let them in. And then Jack Nicholson steals the keys and he's going to escape the asylum. But then, the scene with the young guy whose name I forget, where he kills himself, and then Jack Nicholson goes and strangles, Nurse Ratched and almost kills her. They actually had the opportunity to leave the asylum. Like that entire night, I think the window was open for an entire night. They had the opportunity to get out, but nobody chose to do it until the chief went and picked up the water fountain himself and then smashed it through the window. So I mean, like, there's the element that the imprisonment is not simply the bars, because there was that scene where they all could have just walked out, but they didn't. And it's not as much breaking the actual physical barrier. It's really just breaking the spiritual barrier as well.
Yeah, exactly. It is. Yeah. It's a great movie. There's a few super chats come in, so I want to thank everybody for that. So I think I'll hit them. I've also got a question from Hunky Haggis, which relates to just what I was saying. He sent something on the coffee pot, which I forgot to pin, but never mind. Just wanted to know if you've had any success with waking people up, if there's any techniques you know to unhypnotize them, like asking questions that show contradictions or applying the enemy's methods, like critical theory to the agenda. I could talk about this for a whole other like stream. And despite what I was just saying about the normies, in jobs that I've had in these environments of control, I have actually done it. And I think the first step that you have to do, it seems kind of a bit kind of corny, but the very first step that you have to do is to make people aware that they can say things in front of you. So you'll often find that somebody will say something a little bit politically incorrect in these situations. You know, why not keep it on the work situation, for example? And then they will hesitate and they won't really want to go further until they know where you are. Are you also a heretic, or do they have to watch themselves? And so before you jump in with a load of edgy hot takes and sort of like reciting Kevin MacDonald, whatever, it's best to sort of I know where you're coming from, like I get it as well, like I know all about this kind of stuff, and encourage them, and then what you'll find is that a lot of things will flow immediately from that. I can talk, especially on the critical theory. I did that with a radio in a job that I had, where I just constantly complained because they had Crapital FM on. I've told this story before. It was a sort of reverse critical theory where they ended up where they couldn't defend Crapital FM. And so I put like Absolute Rock on or something. So it was like this mild improvement, like kind of bringing the ratchet forward a little bit. So, but basically the first step is to let them know that they can't speak their minds. That's the first thing. They're not under any danger when they're going to sort of let things flow with you. And then also, which is a mistake that I've made, don't lecture people. You know, like if you're in the pub, I was in the pub last night, and now years ago, I used to get on my high horse and I used to sort of shout and I used to lecture people, and people tend to just to tune out and they get bored. I'd be wary of that. Be wary of being this kind of proselytizing kind of, because it's just people are just going to think you're a pain in the arse. It's all about subtle. And encourage people and give them a nudge here and there is the short answer to that question.
Yeah, I'd add that, like, put it, make it so that they can, it feels like they can figure it out for themselves. So you kind of like lay the foundation for it, but then they kind of have a way of figuring it out on their own, because, you know, for a lot of times that you can tell them this stuff, but then kind of when it really clicks for them is when they see something in their own life, and then they start to think about it in a different way. That's when it kind of really starts to click for them. I have a few examples of that. One guy I knew, I was he was a he was already a bit more like he was already red-pilled on to a certain degree, but with a certain issue, like one that you can't talk about on YouTube, I was the one that brought it up with him, and he was kind of a bit skeptical, but then he said, like, when he actually encountered it for himself, that's when it really clicked for him. Not when I was like lecture, not when I was like lecturing. I wasn't being too bad. Him and I are good friends, but when he saw it for himself, that's when it really clicked for him. So, like, kind of giving them a way to figure it out on their own, and that, like, you put down the you guide them, you guide the way, but then you put them in a situation where they can figure it out on their own based on something that they saw. They kind of have what you said in their back of their mind, and then when they see this, they think, oh yeah, that does seem to actually be quite accurate. So yeah, definitely don't lecture people. Don't, like, try to force it down their throat, because no one likes that.
And then there's Fionnir for, I believe that's ISK3. It's some kind of krona. I'm not sure which one, but thank you very much for that. That's all there is. There's another one from Arklow Rocks. I hope I pronounced that right. What is the most English movie you can think of? I saw this in the chat, and you know, it's kind of a big question, and everybody will have their own. I think it's very subjective, so I can give my interpretation. Like, one movie which I think would be really English would be Scott of the Antarctic, which I think we're going to cover, the one with John Mills. I think that has, like, a really perfect English kind of stoicism, which I like to it. But then one, the problem is, of course, those days didn't last forever. And I also love Get Caught, Part of the World, albeit before my time in the early 70s. And it makes Newcastle and the Northeast more generally just look absolutely horrible. But The Man Who Would Be King, we've covered that one. That's a great
Yeah,
one as
I
well.
was thinking about that one.
So yeah, there's a lot. I mean, we could go through them, but I think if I was to think the quintessentially English movies, probably a David Lean, or one of the older David Lean movies as well, where on Dickens. So that's what I would say to that. What would you say?
Well, you know, I'm not an Englishman, so I do feel a bit, you know, take what I say with a grain of salt. I will say that one I thought of would have been Around the World in 80 Days, which we've covered as well. At least that seems like it's the one that captures the Victorian English gentleman the best. But you know, you could also go with something like Oliver Twist I think David Lean's made Oliver Twist in the 40s, didn't he? That would be a good one.
I think so. I don't know. It's one of those ones where I would get caught out. The Wicker Man, yeah, it's another classic, to be honest.
Another one you could go with was like, oh, could be A Christmas Carol, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. It's subjective. So I'm gonna move on, and another name that I don't know how to pronounce, Au Pempla. I don't know, for $5. Thank you very much. Psychology is talking to a progressive until you agree with they them. What would you say to that endeavor?
As it exists today, yeah, that basically is what that's basically what it has become.
Eremite for 11 Canadian dollars? That were no comment. Thank you very much. Fritjof by a hitting us with the names a day like lads. Fritjof Roosevelt, thanks for all you do. Great stream. So thank you very much, lads, for those super chats. I didn't really expect any, to be honest. I don't really do these things for super chats or anything. I just like to have a more kind of speculative sort of streams where we can go around the place. One th final thing I would love to say about the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is the soundtrack, and it's so haunting and so lovely. And you think like, I know it's a cliche to say it, but you wouldn't get this movie made today. Like, even if you're going to go along and you say, I'm going to have this weird, creepy soundtrack, which is very quiet and eerie, and it's going to be on like a Saw so some kind of saw instrument, and there was just more room. Funny enough, it reflects the movie itself. There was just more room for being experimental and taking risks. Like, what's your movie about? It's about 10 blokes sitting in a nut house with this vindictive cow ruling over them. that's the pitch of the. There's no special effects or anything, and yet just look how thoughtful it is. Look how much you can kind of apply what's happening with it as a meditation on a system of control, what it says about society, what it says about its place. You know, it's a top film, and probably not going to be the last one that we do with Jack Nicholson.
Oh, yeah, there's lots to choose from.
So have you got any idea what we're going to do next time?
I have a couple of ideas, but I think the film I want to do will be The Gray with Liam Neeson.
All right. Yeah, I enjoyed that. That's a more recent one. Well, Liam Neeson's one of those fellas where he's been carrying like all of the weight of the sort of masculine Hollywood on his shoulders.
Yes.
Into his 70s. He's like, he's the last one that's allowed, you know? It's funny because I saw a meme earlier on Twitter or comment, and somebody said Fight Club and American Beauty. Basically, two movies in the 90s where it was about how miserable it was to be wealthy and comfortable in the 90s. I thought that's a ridiculous kind of simplification of what those films are. I also think they're not the same. I think Fight Club's right-wing, and I think American Beauty's a definite progressive left-wing kind of attack on suburbia. But it occurred to us as well that if you look at the main character in Fight Club, who's 30, and he laments, the whole thing is that it's like this soul-crushing consumer conformity. How do we get something more interesting back in our lives? Where is our war? Where is our great struggle? And I thought what this sort of shitlid missed is that the situation now is just the same, except that he would probably never leave his cubicle or go anywhere because of diversity, I guess. So the meaningless are still there. It's just that he's not, the work situation is probably going to be even worse.
Yeah. The nihilism's there, but all the goodies that of 90s abundance aren't there anymore.
No. So, any parting shots on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
No, I like the film. I'm glad we did it. I think I had more to say about it than I thought I would originally. So I think it was a good choice.
Yeah, it's deceptive. And when I watched it again recently, I was like, there's a whole stream in this. There's a lot of deep stuff in this, which we could have probably done covered more, but I'm not firing on all cylinders because I'm too much of an old fart to be sitting in the pub all night. But you've got to live life. If that's the message, that's the parting shot there. You see the way I connected all of that up? You've got to live your life. You've got to enjoy life. So thanks for watching, lads, and I'll catch you next time.